From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi is meeting today with House committee chairs ahead of a meeting this afternoon with all House Democrats to talk impeachment. And today, Representative John Lewis joined the majority calling for it in a speech on the House floor.
I truly believe the time to begin impeachment proceedings against this president has come. To delay or to do otherwise would betray the foundation of our democracy.
The tipping point, President Trump's call in July to the new Ukrainian president, asking him to investigate Trump's political rival Joe Biden. Today, before speaking at the UN, Trump reiterated he thought it was a perfect phone call and the pressure should be on Biden. The president also came up with a new reason for withholding aid to Ukraine. It wasn't a quid pro quo to get an investigation on Biden. It was...
What I want, and I insist on it, is that Europe has to put up money for Ukraine also. Why is it only the United States putting up the money?
NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro has been following all of this action today. Domenico, to the aid first, CNN reporting that Trump withheld that aid before the phone call. But your quick thoughts on this new reasoning?
Well, I mean, this timeline certainly is something that is going to have to get a lot more questions. President Trump has changed the story on multiple occasions. Congress has been asking for the whistleblower complaint and a transcript of the call. Trump said that he assumes that some people will see some of this call and perhaps a readout of it. That is not going to cut it as far as Democrats in Congress go, who are leaning more toward pushing forward with an impeachment inquiry.
Yeah, well, besides a possible quid pro quo with aid, the other prong of the impeachment call is, as you tweeted out, Trump not just accepting foreign interference on his behalf, as was the Russian case, but asking for it from Ukraine. And to remind us, in the call, Trump said then Vice President Biden's push in 2016 to get a Ukrainian prosecutor fired was because the prosecutor was charged with investigating a company on whose board Biden's son, Hunter, sat. In fact, Biden was carrying out the wishes of the Obama administration and other world leaders to get rid of a corrupt Ukrainian prosecutor. And as Lucian Kim has been reporting, Hunter Biden may have been brought on that board to unwittingly make it look like the company was getting cleaned up. But, you know, is this hurting Biden?
Well, I think in the short term, it's actually helping him in the Democratic primary because it's insulating him from criticism from the other opponents. I mean, you might remember for months, Vice President Biden, who has led in all the polls, has been under attack from the other Democratic opponents for his policies, for the direction he wants to take the country. And over the last few days, that he has been completely shielded from any of those attacks. They have not been able to go on the attack against him. And on the facts, on the merits, certainly Biden feels that he can argue and win this case. He's going to speak about it in a little over an hour, where he's expected to call for the impeachment of President Trump if Congress doesn't get everything that they want. And it's important to note here, you know, it really is key, the fact that he was the vice president at the time when this allegation that Trump is putting forward came out. And this was him carrying out Obama administration policy. This was something that was vetted through security groups or an apparatus at the White House, something that did take place. National Security Council, Department of Defense, State Department, the International Monetary Fund was involved, the World Bank, Western alliances, leaders that said that they don't want this prosecutor there, that this person needs to be cleaned up. Now, it doesn't look great that you have Hunter Biden there, who is essentially cashing in on the Biden name. And that is going to be a continued headache for Vice President Biden.
Right. But as we said, maybe also duped in this whole process. Look, John Lewis, the civil rights icon, coming out calling for impeachment. One wonders if he sought permission from House Speaker Pelosi. What do you read into that?
I think it's important. It is important tea leaf reading. I mean, John Lewis is somebody who is close to House Speaker Pelosi. Other people, too, like Debbie Dingell, who often does speak for the congresswoman from Michigan, who often does speak for leadership in many ways. And there are these three chairmen of key committees who've now leaned in that direction for impeachment. So all signs are starting to point toward Democrats at least opening an impeachment inquiry, especially given that the administration is not turning over key documentation.
Right. You also have the seven freshman Democrats in swing states writing an op-ed today calling for impeachment. We spoke with Abigail Stamberger. Those are in swing states. So,
You would think Pelosi was trying to give cover to.
Yeah. Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior political editor and correspondent. Thanks.
You're welcome.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson met with President Trump today at the United Nations General Assembly in New York, and both men downplayed news this morning from the United Kingdom's Supreme Court, which ruled that Johnson's decision to suspend Parliament weeks before a major deadline to leave the European Union was illegal.
I just asked Boris, and, you know, to him it's another day in the office. He's a professional. It's just another day in the office.
Yeah, well, it's tomorrow is another day in Parliament. That's what he said.
The Prime Minister's critics are calling on him to resign over his hardline Brexit tactics, and members of Parliament will return to work tomorrow. The BBC's Rob Watson joins us from London. Hi, Rob.
Hi there, Jeremy. So, where to start?
Let's start where the Prime Minister is. He's in New York for the General Assembly, and he said today that he is still determined to take the UK out of the EU on October the 31st, but that he will respect the court's decision today and Parliament will come back. What happens now?
It's how do you square a circle, isn't it? Because the only way he can do that is if he gets a deal between now and the October sort of 15th, 16th, 17th with the European Union. And that's when there's the next big meeting of EU leaders. Either that, or he would have to be prepared to defy the law in this country and take Britain out of the EU, or try to, without a deal on the 31st of October, which would be, of course, an extraordinary development. And, of course, now that you've had the Supreme Court getting itself involved and ruling on a different matter, but sort of showing that the courts would get involved, I mean, you can clearly see that Mr. Johnson is, how would I put it, in something of a fix.
How unprecedented is it for the Supreme Court in the UK to get involved in something like this, in political matters?
So, of course, they would argue that it's not a political matter, and that's why they have got themselves involved. I mean, they're basically saying, look, you know, no power in the UK, no power either in the old days with the king or now with the government, is without limit or without the ability of review. So in many ways, I don't think the fact that the court has ruled that, you know, there was some limit to the government's ability to suspend Parliament. What was really striking about it was saying that the advice that the Prime Minister had given to the Queen was unlawful.
That he was lying to the Queen about why he wanted to suspend Parliament.
Well, the court didn't say that because the court didn't get into the Prime Minister's motives. But, of course, a lot of politicians have said, look, you know, the court may be super sweet about that kind of thing, but the way we see it, guys, is that the Prime Minister lied to Queen and country, and that really what he wanted to do was to just get Parliament politicians out the way and not snooping around his Brexit policy, or as his critics would say, rather a lack of one.
So here's the opposition Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn celebrating the court's decision today. He told a gathering of his party that Johnson was guilty of contempt for democracy and abuse of power.
And I invite Boris Johnson, in the historic words, to consider his position.
Which, Rob, is British for resign. What kind of bind is the Prime Minister in now?
Well, he is in a bind, but it's sort of really interesting that Mr. Johnson's reaction so far has suggested that he's basically doubling down on the whole Brexit bet. What do I mean by that? That he's not going to resign, he hasn't apologised, and it seems to me that so far in his reaction that he's going down this route of saying, this is the people versus the elites, whether it's judges, politicians, they're trying to stop Brexit. And I think in that, he really has, if you like, sort of hit on the heart of the UK's Brexit crisis, undoubtedly the most profound crisis this country has faced since 1945. And that is this: you can either take Boris Johnson's view that the reason why, you know, Brexit hasn't happened yet or is proving difficult is because Remainers, whether they're judges or other EU countries, they're all trying to get in the way. Or you could take the view that the reason why Brexit hasn't happened is because the whole project is so ill thought out, ill founded, so kind of complex, and that the reason why it hasn't happened is that politicians are grappling with that. I mean, they're just finding it incredibly difficult to know how to form an agreement, a majority, on what to do about what it is that people voted for.
OK, so let me just ask you three questions here. Chances that Johnson resigns in the near future?
I think you couldn't rule it out. I mean, I think he might choose to resign rather than have to ask the European Union for an extension to the Brexit process. Next one.
Chances that there will be an election before October 31st.
Slim, I would say. But you've led me on to an interesting one, because I think unless Mr. Johnson is prepared to defy the law or to get a deal somehow with the EU, Britain is not going to leave the European Union on the 31st of October, and there will be an extension to the Brexit process. And I think at that point you have to have what you would call a democratic event. And why I say that is it probably means a general election. You'd have to have another general election, and then depending on who won that general election, in all likelihood, possibly another referendum. Last question. Go on.
I was asking you about another referendum, but there it is.
There you go. And I think, you know, I mean, I think just briefly on that, most politicians at this moment, they are very reluctant to have another referendum. But I go back to that original point that if the politicians can't agree on what to do about that first referendum in 2016, well, guess what? They might have to have another one.
That's the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, in London. Rob, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
This week, we're looking at how the White House is reshaping legal immigration. Yesterday, we heard from Muzaffer Chishti, an attorney for the Migration Policy Institute, who told us he's concerned about the tightening of restrictions for legal immigrants over the last couple years.
One of the great things about our immigration, frankly, has been is that we have welcomed family. We have been diverse in the number and in the types of people we pick. And that diversity, I think, is in jeopardy.
Well, in his remarks about immigration policy and his justifications for certain immigration-related decisions, President Trump has frequently cited data from a group called the Center for Immigration Studies. That's a think tank that advocates for lower levels of legal immigration and has significant influence in the Trump White House. Jessica Vaughn is director of policy studies at the center. She's advised the White House on immigration issues and joins us now. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you.
So when you look at the big picture on legal immigration, the White House is advancing an agenda that includes reducing the refugee admissions cap, slowing down visa processes, and denying more visas to many immigrants, high-skilled immigrants and lower-skilled immigrants, and now these proposed changes to the public charge rule. Is it fair to say that your group, the Center for Immigration Studies, that these changes line up with what you believe?
Well, yes, those changes are important for a variety of reasons, not only because of so much fraud and abuse in our immigration system and because of difficulty in managing the workload, but these changes are not going to significantly reduce the overall levels of legal immigration, which is really the biggest problem with our immigration system. And the other problem is that our current legal immigration system distorts our labor market and causes problems for American workers. So these changes really are tweaks around the system when really what we need is a more fundamental overhaul of our legal immigration system to match our national interest and be more modern because we are a more modern society than we were back in the 50s and 60s when this system was created.
So you think that the Trump administration is not going far enough in reducing legal immigration?
That's right. We need to take a look at our legal immigration system. We're now bringing in more than 1 million people every year. And while the administration has reduced refugee numbers, that is a small part of our immigration system. The biggest part is the family immigration system, which represents about 2/3 of the total of that 1 million people who come every year. People who are coming in on the basis of skills or a job offer, that category represents only about 14% of our legal immigration system. Our research shows that that's out of whack with our national needs.
What do you mean by that? What are our national needs that would be served by not having so many family members be able to come in easily legally?
Well, as I mentioned, the numbers of people that we're getting are distorting the labor market because of the fact that we have a largely family-driven immigration system. That means the people we are admitting are coming in just because they're related to someone who came before. And that means that we are getting a disproportionate number of immigrants who are going to be consigned to accepting jobs with lower wages. They are depressing wages and displacing that share of the American population that, for whatever reason, hasn't had access to higher education and is also needs to find work in those skill sectors, or I should say really low skill sectors of occupations. And, you know, this is a vulnerable group of Americans who are challenged more than they need to be in the labor market.
So you're saying you think that if we weren't bringing in people who would take these low skill or low paying jobs, that Americans would step in to those jobs?
Absolutely. We've seen our labor force participation rates right now are very low. But more importantly, what we would see is if we moderated levels of immigration, particularly family immigration, it would likely result in better wages and working conditions for everybody who is working in those fields. For example, wage rates in construction and the hotel and restaurant industry and manufacturing, those have not grown in 20 years. And one of the reasons is that many of the immigrants that we've admitted over those years have worked in those sectors. And so it keeps people's earnings artificially suppressed.
And you think that's the only reason for that, though? I mean, there are many reasons why earnings have been suppressed in many different fields.
Of course, you know, globalization has something to do with it, and certain, you know, regulation and certain other things. But immigration is something that we can control at the federal level.
What do you think is the right number of legal immigrants that should be coming into the U.S. every year?
There's no magic number, but I would suggest that people take a look at the Jordan Commission report from the mid-1990s that found that if we did away with, for example, the visa lottery and some of the extended family categories of immigration and cut back in a number of programs, immigration could come down to more along the lines of 500,000, 700,000 people a year, which would be a significant reduction and ease some of these labor market distortions that we found. We could cut out a lot of fraud, and that would also bring the numbers down.
Isn't it bigger, though, than a policy? Isn't this sort of part of our DNA going back to the beginning of this country? Give me, you're tired, you're poor. That immigration is just part of what makes this country what it is.
Well, I think all Americans cherish our tradition of immigration, and many people are the descendants of immigrants. And so we want to have immigration, but we need to look at our policy to make sure that we're bringing in immigrants who are going to be self-sufficient, who want to become Americans. And just like all other policies evolve with our national needs, immigration should be no different. There's no reason to stay on autopilot.
Are you concerned that by getting more restrictive in legal immigration in this country, that there will be effects such as some of the highly skilled immigrants who may come in to do important research or work at a tech company are going to decide that the process is becoming too difficult and maybe they can't bring their spouse over to the United States with them because of changes to how easy it is for family members to get in? And then they decide, you know what? We'll go to Australia, we'll go to Canada, we'll go to Europe instead.
Well, anyone who comes in on a legal visa or gets a green card can always bring their spouse and their minor children with them. That's not going to change, and that shouldn't change.
But the process is getting more difficult for a lot of people.
Well, one of the reasons that the process is getting difficult is because there has been so much fraud and abuse in that category that now the Trump administration has tightened the procedures, and that preserves the legal immigration system for everybody. I mean, there's no point in having rules for legal immigration if they're not going to be enforced and people can just ignore the rules or break the rules. If we can transform our visa, our employment visas and green cards to focus on merit, education, skills that people have, job offers, ability to speak English, lots of things that ways that we can screen people that would make our employment-based system a truly merit-based system rather than one that just is to the benefit of employers in certain sectors. That would be a really positive reform, and I think would be true to our goal of trying to bring the best and the brightest immigrants who want to come here.
But I imagine that there are a lot of listeners who are hearing you say that, and they're thinking, well, wait a minute. If you cut legal immigration almost in half in this country, who is going to, pick the vegetables in the fields? Who is going to be a home health care aide, which is, more than 23% of them, nursing aides born outside the United States? There are so many jobs that are not in the high skill, merit category you're talking about, that would have a difficult time finding the employees that they need to fill them.
Well, I think a lot of those jobs would be done by Americans as they are today. There really is no such thing as a job an American won't do. And we have millions of people, especially people who didn't finish high school, didn't get to go to college, who've actually dropped out of the labor market. And a lot of these jobs, honestly, American workers don't even find out about them because the recruiting to fill these jobs takes place, outside where American workers would go to find jobs.
As you know, there are a lot of Americans who believe that the president's immigration policies are racist. What do you say to that criticism?
I don't think that the president's policies are racist at all. The president is working to implement an immigration system that works for Americans, works for the legal immigrants who are already here, and one that enforces the rules so it's fair for everyone who qualifies.
That is Jessica Vaughn, who is Director of Policy Studies for the Center for Immigration Studies, which advocates for lower levels of immigration and also advises the White House on the issue. Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, we heard a very different view on the show yesterday. You can find that conversation at hereandnow.org. Tomorrow, we'll hear from people who are affected by President Trump's policies around legal immigration, a university official who says her school is struggling to get the international faculty it needs, and an entrepreneur who chose Toronto over Silicon Valley because of Canada's simpler immigration process.
What does it take to turn an idea into reality, even when no one else believes you can? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with innovators about their influential brands and the stories behind them, the failures, triumphs, and everything in between.
President Trump addressed the UN General Assembly today in New York. He touched on tensions with Iran, trade disputes with China, and also defended his stance of putting America first.
Wise leaders always put the good of their own people and their own country first. The future does not belong to globalists. The future belongs to patriots.
Joining us now is Michelle Kellerman, NPR diplomatic correspondent who's at the UN. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jeremy.
So President Trump spoke for about a half an hour earlier today. He talked about China, Iran, North Korea, Afghanistan, Venezuela. What's your headline from today's speech?
Well, as you heard him saying there, I mean, he's basically telling world leaders to do as he does, take steps that are in the interests of their own countries, shake up the global trade system, which he says has been unfair. There was not much talk about tackling global problems together. He was really blasting globalism. And he's also urging countries to follow his lead on Iran. That's kind of been a tough sell. He pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal and has been reimposing sanctions. Iran calls it economic warfare, and we've seen kind of a spike in attacks blamed on Iran in recent months. And there's been a lot of concerns about rising tensions in the Middle East as a result.
What are European leaders saying about Iran following the president suspending peace talks recently with the Taliban?
Well, there's been kind of a flurry of diplomatic activity here, mostly on Iran, I should say. The UK, Germany, France, all signatories of the Iran nuclear deal, are blaming Iran for the recent attack on Saudi oil facilities, essentially backing President Trump on this. But they're also saying that it's time for Iran to come back to the negotiating table and talk about not just bolstering the nuclear deal, but also about regional security. French President Emmanuel Macron met with Iran's president. Angela Merkel met with him as well. They're both meeting separately with President Trump. So there's just a lot of emphasis on how to de-escalate and get back to some sort of negotiations.
The president did not mention climate change, even after that forceful speech from the Swedish teen activist Greta Thunberg, who demanded climate action yesterday. In fact, he made fun of her on Twitter. How have other leaders responded to Thunberg?
Well, I think most of them are, you know, happy that she came here and gave that kind of a message. The Secretary General has made climate change quite a big issue here at the United Nations. He spoke about it again in his speech today. But as you mentioned, President Trump didn't talk about that at all. And he, in fact, didn't really attend the climate summit yesterday. He only stopped in for a few minutes.
What did he say, if anything, about the situation with Ukraine, given that as he's at the UN, Democrats are talking a lot more about impeachment today in Washington?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. On his way in here, he basically confirmed reporting that he held up aid to Ukraine before he spoke to the new Ukrainian leader by phone. But he says the aid eventually did go through. He claimed that his main reason of holding up that aid was to get the Europeans to pay more, not just him. It's an odd argument, though, because the Trump administration has always said that, you know, it was doing something that the Obama administration refused to do, giving military aid to Ukraine to defend itself from Russia. The French and the Germans haven't been very keen on military aid from the beginning. They're mostly focused on diplomatic efforts to end the war. And, you know, this is a key moment for diplomacy on Ukraine.
That is NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman at the UN. Michelle, thanks.
Sure thing.
Recently, the event room at Boston's Old South Church was packed with members of the local chapter of United for a Fair Economy, the economic rights organization, and Responsible Wealth, a UFE project that brings together inheritors, people who've inherited extreme wealth and agree with UFE that creating a fair and equitable economy benefits everyone, but truly the lowest paid, which includes many of these United for a Fair Economy activists.
When we're talking about the effects of economic oppression and the ways in which they hurt us, there are moments in which we have to pause. And sometimes that's a struggle for people in economic justice.
And sometimes we have worries around money, right?
Yes.
It's hard to talk about money sometimes, right? And so we just got to not tell ourselves the story that the world is telling us and create a new one.
Tonight, they've gathered to break bread and award others, including Abigail Disney, granddaughter of Roy, grandniece of Walt Disney, and heiress to the family fortune. She recently spoke out against Disney's treatment of workers. We sat down to talk about the award she'd be receiving.
The Traitor to Your Class Award.
I love it. And I've been saying for years in my family that I'm a traitor to my class. And it has always been meant with a sense of humor and never greeted with laughter.
Well, what does this mean to you to receive it?
They're fellow travelers, right? You know, it's so satisfying because then you recognize you're not crazy.
Well, and you know there are people who think you are. Just be quiet and have your wealth. Yeah. And when you say fellow travelers, a lot of people in this room, they're barely scraping together, you know, minimum wage, if that. But you seem completely comfortable.
There have been times in my life where I've been in rooms full of low-income people who are not happy to see me. And the resentment is something I very much understand.
Is that what you're saying? You feel resentment from them?
Oh, sometimes. But I'm very committed to the idea that the people who work hardest in this society are the people who are least rewarded.
We'll talk about the very specific thing you're talking about, which was Bob Iger's salary. It bothered you that his salary was, what, 787 times?
No, I don't begrudge him his salary, honestly. What I begrudge him is that salary at the same time as there are people struggling to get by on the wage they're being paid. That's what I don't understand, is that you can walk home with $130 million for a single year's work and at the same time know that less than 20 miles from where you lay your head on the pillow peacefully, there's somebody who can't guarantee that tomorrow morning there will be enough food. I just don't understand how there's not too much shame.
You are getting emotional about this.
I am. I find that disparity unsettling. I've never been comfortable with it, and I honestly don't understand people who are.
You went to Disneyland, and you talked to workers, and you say that they told you things like that, that they were, what, scrounging from dumpsters in one case?
You know, I might have been hyperbolic with the dumpster thing. I get emotional. But their hours are being limited so that they cannot put together enough hours to qualify for full time and therefore benefits. That's a major violation of some very basic principles of fairness. There are people who aren't paid enough to afford their insulin. This is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. That's been happening at this company.
Did they know you were at Disney?
Mm-hmm. In fact, it was really nice. I mean, Disney, there were people who described it as a cult in the early days because the people who came to work were real believers in the idea that there was a principle. They were selling soda and a dream. And the workers I met with could have gotten more pay elsewhere, but wouldn't have had the personal satisfaction of working for Disney. And they were at the breaking point. That's what makes me upset. They were so sweet when I came into that room because they were so excited to meet me, because I knew my grandfather and my father, and they, you know, they're legends. The fact that that coexists with people trying to make ends meet makes me so crazy, because they have such loyalty and commitment to what they're doing. And that loyalty is not being rewarded or even mentioned.
Well, you know, after you went public with these comments, Disney, the company, came back and said that their workers earn an average $19.50 an hour. They offer benefits and initiatives like free colleges. In some cases, you're smiling. You've heard this.
Of course I've heard it. Education is wonderful, but it asks you to actively support this narrative, which is that if you're in a low-paying job, you're only in it on your way to a better-paying job. There is no regard for the person who spends 20 years as a hotel maid, a janitor, a custodian, or whatever. And if you do not intend to scrub your own freaking toilet, then you had better be willing to pay the person who does it in your stead. That whole idea of betterment implies that a person who's cleaning the toilets isn't really already enough. Average 1950 doesn't tell you anything about the bottom. Disney employees are very happy from the middle up.
And that's your point, and I hear your point. Because I was going to say, and by the way, full disclosure, I went to college with Bob Iger, but I mean, this is the pushback. He did increase Disney stock fivefold. I read that the Avengers Endgame made $1.2 billion in one weekend. So you know, people
would have reason to pay your minimum wage workers a dignified salary.
Talk a little bit about how you came to this sense of that amount of money being obscene. You considered yourself maybe upper middle class growing up, but nothing compared to what was going to happen in the 1980s when Michael Eisner took Disney through the roof. And suddenly your father has a private 737 jet.
Yeah. And I flew in it alone once, and that was really a watershed for me. But what I saw in my father himself was there was a lessening regard for being thoughtful, making sure that people got enough time off.
You've explained, have I got this right, because he wasn't having to do this huge part of life that people have to do, which is travel with your fellow man.
Exactly. You begin to forget that you're part of the same human race. You come, I think, to start believing that you're really all that great. And it's an empathy killer.
People manage to hold on to their humanity and have a jet. And as you say, money is morally neutral. It doesn't make you good by having it.
Right.
But it also doesn't make you bad by having it.
It doesn't make you bad. There are plenty of people I know who walk around in a cloud of shame who've inherited money. And it's very important that we make sure they know that they're no worse than anyone else.
You seem to get a little emotional there, too. I mean, you talk about you have a new baby and people are giving you Mickey Mouse diapers and you want to throw up.
Yeah, you
is that shame?
Yes, I started in great shame, and I worked it out over, 10, 15 years of a lot of therapy and thinking and having my own children.
You were one of 19 very wealthy Americans to sign an open letter to the Democratic presidential candidates, ask for a moderate wealth tax. What does that look like to you, by the way?
I don't think it's unreasonable at all to tax wealth. We, I think, as wealthy people, use up plenty of government services. You know, I think it starts around $10 million, but okay, let's go up to $20 million. I think it's not unreasonable to take 1%, 1.5%, 2%. Everybody with $1 billion is making 5 to 8 to 12 to 20% every year on the money that they're having. So a 1 to 2% wealth tax would never undermine the capacity wealthy people have to grow their fortune. Disney has 200,000 employees. Disney took $3.5 billion from their tax windfall in 2018 and made share buybacks. At any time that Disney chooses, it could raise the wages of the bottom 20% of its employees without affecting profitability.
Everybody's looking at you and saying, yeah, but that's what my dream is,
yeah,
to be that as wealthy as you are.
Yeah, exactly. And so if I complain about it or if I say I have too much, it's like I'm criticizing this fantasy they have of themselves.
You're attacking the American dream.
Sure. I'm attacking the idea that the American dream is still valid, because it's not. The ladder out of poverty that my grandfather and great uncle climbed is no longer available. People's lives and destinies are determined more by their zip code, the color of their skin, their education level.
And you're being honored by what, at least in part, looks like a lot of people of color and low wage. You're going to be sitting down at paper-covered tables and dining with them. This is not a Met Gala.
The best dinners are on white paper tablecloths, and they have brought me the best friendships and the most meaningful relationships I have.
Abigail Disney, heir to the Disney fortune, who shortly after we spoke received the Traitor to Her Class Award from the Boston chapter of the economic rights nonprofit United for a Fair Economy and its offshoot, Responsible Wealth. For more, go to hearandnow.org.
You may remember that earlier this year there was heavy rain and record flooding in parts of the Midwest. Well, there's been an interesting side effect, a surge in frog and toad populations. People in parts of Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska along the Missouri River have reported thousands of frogs in their yards and fields. The Missouri Department of Conservation say all of that standing water created new habitats for frogs to lay eggs. Even rare species like the Great Plains toad have benefited from the flooding. Well, there are a lot of frogs in the mountains and prairies of Wyoming, too, but you might be surprised to discover that scientists know very little about them, where exactly they live, or the conditions they like best. So this year, scientists from several organizations are conducting surveys to understand more about the frogs and their habitat. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
So the adventure begins.
Yes, it does.
The sun is starting to set over a gravel road next to ranchland. Project leader Katrina Cook and her field technician Becky Blankenship are preparing for the first nocturnal call survey of the night.
Do you have a timer on you?
They need a timer because nocturnal call surveys are 3-minute intervals in which the two scientists stand at a single spot and just listen for frogs of any kind in any direction.
It's valuable information because we still don't know where these guys all are and where they exist.
So the Bureau of Land Management, in partnership with the state agency and Wyoming's Natural Diversity Database, organized a 2-season project to survey where frogs are and how many are out there. Cook is leading the on-the-ground effort, collecting surveys in potential habitat to make up that baseline data.
Ideally, we would know how numbers are for each species. We would know where to find them, how to find them best.
By the end of 2020, this information will be available to land managers to inform decision-making, say how to handle changes to a pond where frogs live. But all that starts with nights like tonight, doing a handful of simple, silent surveys. Just before 9 p.m., it begins.
Timer good?
Yep.
Okay, and start.
This keeps going for 2 minutes and 50 seconds.
One. I think there's two. Yeah, okay. Probably those two different ones.
Surveys like this one can only happen in the summer because it's mating season. Those croaks you often hear are mating calls, but not all frogs croak.
For all dudes.
All dudes. Yep. It's a boy band.
Tonight, Cook and Blankenship complete 22 auditory surveys. They also record temperature, humidity, which direction they herd the frogs, hopefully to show what conditions frogs prefer.
Okay.
Next stop?
Next stop. Good start.
Okay. Soon, they repeat the process. And again. And again. And again. You get the idea. And before too long, it's completely dark out.
Oh, shooting star! That was cool.
The temperature has dropped, and it's really quiet. No highway noise or residential hubbub. Cook and Blankenship are deep in the prairie. And from the sound, you can tell. Back in the car, Cook says she appreciates the quiet of this work.
I think being able to just enjoy silence is nice. But you're also getting to connect with nature in a way that not a lot of people get to. I mean, this job has us standing outside, you know, for 3 minutes, and all you're doing is focusing on what's around you auditorily. So, I don't know.
It's now past 1 a.m. We've driven 9 miles and completed more than 20 surveys. The fatigue may be setting in.
Get to the point where you're, at least I know, I get tired enough, I just get silly. And things just become funny that normally would not be funny, so.
Like a cow breathing heavily.
Well, that's hilarious. They finish up the last 3 minute interval, then it's back to the campsite to sleep. Those surveys, and many more to come, will be compiled into a final report after the summer of 2020. It'll include a map so scientists can finally have a baseline of where all these species are, whether their habitats have expanded or shrank.
You know, they'll be able to use this data to base and plan the next field seasons of whatever project they do. It's kind of like we're constantly, it's almost like we're a big team and we're helping each other out.
Tonight was one step towards collecting data that could have a big impact. It's 2:30 a.m. now, and everyone is very tired, but satisfied with the day's work. For Here and Now, I'm Cooper McKim.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.